Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Welcome to the PTSD and Beyond podcast, where we give you insights into post-traumatic stress, trauma recovery, healing, and beyond. I'm Dr. Deb Lind, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind, touch your heart, and connect with your spirit, and also give you a greater understanding of yourself and others on this healing and recovery journey walked by so many of us before, wounded healers with lived experience and heroes. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into possibilities and purpose, hope, and inspiration. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. One last thing, guys, before we dive into today's episode, if you'd like an ad-free experience and like early access to new episodes and special events, I want to let you know you can join us at patreon.com. That is patreon.com/PTSD and beyond. All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. And guess what? We have a guest who's been on before and we're welcoming him back. And the reason why is he's going to talk about one of his books that he's written. It's called A Greater Good. And I hope everybody is interested in listening to a story. You know, there's something about stories, storytelling, and listening to stories that captivates us, has us put in a pause, and it dates back to centuries. Where, yes, believe it or not, before the internet, before we had a library of books, people would gather around and listen to stories. So today we're going to welcome back Wilton, who's a psychotherapist, been practicing for over 40 years, and is also an accomplished international author. So Terry Wilton, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. And, you know, I really appreciate what you say about stories, because I think Of a means of communication, stories have a much more powerful impact on us, much more powerful than theories or opinions or data.
Yeah,
stories actually create emotions within us, and they help us to understand the richness of the world around us. So I'm really glad. Now I have to correct. I'm no longer working as a psychotherapist. I have let my credentials as a psychologist lapse, coming into my retirement, so that I can focus really much more on writing at this point. But I still have the heart of a psychologist, if you can think of psychologists having a heart. I
suppose. And you bring that heart and intelligence with your stories, which is really super fascinating, because our listeners, at least I know for myself, you know, it's like, okay, this is going to be really super amazing and cool to listen to today. So you bring all that with you.
Well, let's hope. We'll give it a good go, won't we? So I do want to start with a story. So I'm going to go back about 5 years in time. And one of the things I was doing at that point was I was doing a lot of supervision of psychologists that were coming into practice who were just completing their registration requirements. And so I was often going out to other agencies as an external supervisor, coming in and working with people and helping people to move away from all the notions they had in graduate school about what this was about, and learning how to do it day in, day out, and to manage the human side of it. And I obviously was coming from a very humanistic perspective rather than necessarily a theoretical perspective. So anyway, to set the stage for this story, I'm sitting at a table in a McDonald's that was just down the mall corridor from where the agency was. And there was half a dozen or so of mental health therapists that were delaying going into their offices to start their work for the day. So they were sitting around having a cup of coffee, and my supervisee was there. And so I came and joined them all, and they were all quite young. And, you know, maybe a couple of psychologists in the mix, a lot of psychiatric social workers, some psych nurses, that sort of thing. So I had just written a column for the magazine that goes out to psychologists in my province on the changes that I had noticed in the 40 years that I had been practicing. And one of the changes was that our profession had become much more technical. Now, I'm going to explain a couple of things about that. First of all, when I began practice, there were three schools of psychotherapy. There was behavior therapy, there was psychoanalytic therapy, and there was client-centered therapy. Back in those early days, Gestalt was just emerging as a type of therapy. But now, 40 years later, like there's dozens of different therapies, and they're all kind of competing with each other and trying to have their own niche and prove that they were effective. So it had become much more complicated as a psychologist. You had to become versed in all of these different therapies and how to use them. But another thing had changed in terms of ethics. So when I got into the field, there was the only ethical document was the Canadian Code of Ethics for Psychologists. And it ran about 20 pages. And it said a lot of good things, you know, that you needed to be careful of and what you should do. But as I was supervising these psychologists starting practice, I now had a one-inch binder. And it was filled with codes and guidelines and standards and jurisprudence findings and interpretations of guidelines and I was having to help all of these psychologists coming into practice to this is the foundation, and it was so much more complicated than when I had first gotten in, so much more technical. But then, and this is the other amazing part, when I got into the field, I was working with the initial DSM. And back then it was ICD-8, the International Classifications of Diseases, the 8th edition. And I remember a document, and I think it was a DSM, that had a little paragraph about each mental health diagnosis. And basically you could sit down and read the thing in an afternoon. It was that sparse in terms of the descriptions. Now, my students were having to learn the DSM-5, which is 1,000 pages of fine print. And so I was talking about how much more technical our field had become in the 40 years that I had practiced. And then I look around the table. Oh, and the other thing that I wanted to say was, if we're getting that much more technical, we need to really strive to be human.
Right.
To up our sense of humanity to balance that high degree of technology, or we just become technologists.
Right.
Rather than being in a human relationship with our clients.
Right.
So I'm looking around the table, and these are all people at the beginning of their career. And then I ask the question, I wonder what it's going to be like for you when you're at the 40-year mark of the profession.
Mm-hmm.
If we continue to get so much more technical as we've gotten in my 40 years, what's it going to look like?
Right.
Well, immediately the answer came to mind. I answered my own question. Immediately the answer came to mind was, well, you go for therapy. It's not going to be with a human being. It's going to be with an avatar in a virtual reality room that's run by artificial intelligence. Basically telling all these people that you're going to be out of a job in 40 years. It's going to be replaced by a computer. And then I thought, gosh, how lacking in humanity that is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they'll develop a different profession that will compensate for that. And immediately the word that came to mind is, well, if you're going to have an avatar doing therapy with you, you need a psyche buddy. Somebody that will come along and be your companion as you explore these things about yourself. And in thinking about psyche buddies, well, the psyche buddies probably don't need a university education, but they need to have the right personality. And why don't we raise them in attachment optimal environments? And why don't we train them right from the word go in all of their education to be able to do the job? And so I decided that I was going to write a column about psyche buddies. And actually, the way I wrote the next column that I wrote for the magazine was premised on an email that somebody 40 years in the future writes to me in the present and says, "Hey, I read your article about the 40 years of change. I thought I'd let you know what has happened in the next 40 years. And he describes the avatars and virtual reality rooms and the psyche buddies. And I was sharing that column with a colleague, and she looked at it and she read it, and it was kind of amusing and all that sort of thing. And then she said, "Terry, this isn't a column, this is a novel." And so the novel, A Greater Good, was born.
Wow.
And as soon as Jeanine had mentioned that to me, I immediately started to conceptualize. And so the novel, A Greater Good, takes place 40 years in the future. And it documents the story of two psyche buddies, but actually I changed the name in the novel to Paracletes. And for those of you who know theology or Greek, well, you're Greek, Paraclete is an ancient word that means someone who comes alongside to help.
Mm-hmm.
And so the novel follows the story of two Paracletes just as they graduate. They had been bred and they had been raised in optimal communal environments, and they had attachment optimal environments, and they had been trained right from the word go with all of the skills that they would need to be the perfect human companions. So that was the premise of the story. Now, the way that I write is I start with a premise and I start with some characters and I put them through some things and suddenly see what happens in the story. So I don't want to give away too much of the story here because I want people to go and read it.
And for people who are wondering, where can we find this book, A Greater Good? The hyperlink to Wilton's book is directly in the summary bio. So if you want to go check it out, it's available on Amazon. And that hyperlink will take you directly to the Amazon. So you can go ahead and download that book. You can. It's on Kindle and also paperback, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It's and it's on Kobo as well.
Oh, cool.
I think it's on Apple Books too. I'm not sure. So you should be able to find it there. So just telling a little bit about the story is set 40 years in the future, and it is a dystopia. If you think in terms of, you know, some very famous dystopias like Brave New World and 1984 and Handmaid's Tale. But this one is different because this is about a society that is structured around meeting everyone's needs. And everyone's needs are met even before they know they have those needs. So people have an implant in their bodies that identify what they need physically, and it is just automatically made available in the stores around so that those needs are met. And psychological needs are met by these avatars in the virtual reality rooms who do this form of therapy. And the Paracletes come alongside and help people along. But the one thing that is missing is personal freedom.
Is personal freedom?
Personal freedom. Because as every need is met, even before the person understands that they have that needs, the environment in this dystopian tale has been engineered so that everyone is just simply living out their lives according to what the broader society is expecting of them. And so for the philosophers in the audience, what I intended with this book is that it looks at the difference between a society that maximizes the greatest good for the greatest number, which is a philosophical position of utilitarianism,
mm-hmm.
Versus looking at what was the next or an annex development in philosophy in terms of existentialism, in looking at fundamentally what does it mean to be human?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we manage the essentials of our humanity within the context that we are in. So the story is basically, so we start with a greater good, which is what this dystopian society tried to create, a society that met everyone's needs. And then we emerge into how people within that society began to be recognizing that they had lost their privacy, they had lost their sense of personal agency, and that they were simply following the path of the society had laid out for them. So along the way, we watch these two Pericles, who are just 18 years old.
Oh, wow, they're young.
They're young, yeah. Well, they just graduated, and we watch them, and I don't want to give too much away, but there happens to be a love triangle that develops, and there happens to be a murder that takes place. So all of those things that make a novel's plot interesting, we've tried to include to keep the reader going until the end.
Wow. In this story, what can you envision actually coming to play? So where my thought is, you know, back in the day, and I know when we got together in our first episode, I shared about, you know, we could watch the Jetsons, for example, you know, the Hanna-Barbera cartoon, and, you know, they've got the video screen with, you know, the mom communicating with the mother, right? And that was so far-fetched, but here we are, here we are with Zoom technology or other platforms that allow us to have video, you know, video conferencing. You can even pick up your phone and do the same thing. You know, you can see your kids no matter where they're at around the world, or your loved ones, or anybody that you want to connect with. So what elements that are in the story that might have the same feeling and sensation of that is really so far in the future, and yet it's possible to have that reality come out from the story? So what are some of those things we can think about this?
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And I hope that you're truly enjoying today's podcast episode. If you'd like more information about what PTSD and Beyond is, what we do, the services that we provide, our workshops, our training, our keynotes, and our coaching, drop us a line at hello@ptsdandbeyond.org. All right, let's continue on with today's episode.
Well, I have an awesome example for you. So one of the things in terms of mental health treatment in the future was that there was a technology for impacting on the brain that used ultrasonic waves. Mm-hmm. And it used multiple sources of ultrasonic waves so that they potentiated each other at particular points. And that created within the brain at a very specific targeted point, a source of energy that would cause damage or would facilitate that part of the brain working harder. So there was this ultrasonic technology. And I had imagined, well, this is something that might occur 40 years from now, that we might be able to do. It's sort of like a bloodless brain surgery. You don't have to actually go in with a knife.
Right, correct.
You go in with sound waves. And I had actually talked to a friend who knew physics really well and run the idea by him. And he thought, well, you know, that's possible. So, okay, it's going to be an interesting plot line in the story. The very week that my novel was published, this is back 5 years ago, I read an article in the Globe and Mail, which is one of the national newspapers here in Canada, to indicate that scientists were experimenting with that very procedure.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh my gosh, really? And I had put that 40 years into the future. Now, I don't know where it's gone since then, but in looking ahead, I had imagined, you know, that might be something that could happen. And it is something that has been actually with some research already going into it. The other thing that I developed, and this is, you know, we're talking about 5 years ago, and everything is basically public transportation rather than private vehicles 40 years in the future. And the vehicles that I imagined, you would simply, like you would dial up for a taxi, you simply dialed up for an autonomous vehicle on demand that would come and pick you up at your door.
Oh, wow.
And it's sort of like a driverless Uber that had developed. And that wasn't existing 5 years ago, but we have Uber now and we have autonomous vehicles now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that thing that I imagined happening 40 years in the future might be 4 years from now. So it was interesting to see how the things that are in the present give us ideas about things that can happen in the future. But I think there, in terms of this, there's a cautionary tale about the novel, like all dystopian novels are. Basically, dystopian novels say, hey, be careful, this is what might happen.
Right.
If we take the trends that we currently are facing,
right,
and we extend them into the future. And so, you know, I think the cautionary tale is around what do we do if technology becomes so powerful that it replaces the human side of relationships.
Right, correct.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, and I've just gone back because I wrote it 5 years ago, I've just had to go back and kind of refresh myself with the plot and everything and the characters. A number of years ago, I was aware of the concept of iatrogenic harm, or harm that is caused by medical professionals, where the interventions they use might be inappropriate or too powerful and end up, instead of helping, they end up doing harm. And quite a few of my followers, or the people that I'm following on Twitter, have talked about the iatrogenic harm that has come to them in terms of psychiatric treatment. And I was noticing when I was going back and looking in the novel that that theme is there as well. The recognition that actually in the novel, it is written about 15 years after the death of psychiatry.
Oh, wow.
Psychiatry got replaced by neurology. Which is also an interesting concept, because in our own looking at mental health treatment models, certain approaches come and have their heyday and then they dissipate.
Right.
And at their heyday, we think that this is finally, we've got it right. This is how we're supposed to do it. And then if you look at things 20 years after that heyday, you recognize that, hey, that approach to things has really died out. And so,
right. Like, we don't use leeches any longer, even though
we don't,
you know,
and we don't feel that for the bumps on the surface of the skull to do personality assessment.
Right. Correct. Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
So which we used to do. So anyway, so the novel is taking a look at the mental health industry and projecting it into the future and basically saying, hey, this is where things might end up if we allow current trends to continue. But the other thing that novel does is there's this strong sense of rebellion against it and a strong sense of we need to be perpetuating healthy relationships with each other. And the ultimate healing comes from that those healthy relationships.
Do you think that it's going to be a full circle then? So is there a sequel to A Greater Good?
Unfortunately not. And people keep saying they're disappointed. The people that have read A Greater Good keep saying they're disappointed that there isn't a sequel to it. Maybe that will be written sometime in the future.
You know, the reason why I'm asking is because we have a timeline here of 40 years. And then the question was posed to the students, you know, what do you think 40 years out is going to look like?
Yes.
And so we have an 80-year time span. And the other thing that I'm curious about is the psyche buddies. Is it possible that the Psyche Buddies are currently today, the seed to Psyche Buddies is peer support.
Yes, it could very well be. And the interesting thing about Psyche Buddies, when they're actually doing their work, they're doing very ordinary things. Like if you realize in going to your therapist that you really need to get in better shape, but you have trouble getting to the gym, the Psyche Buddy says, well, I'll go with you. I'll run on the other treadmill beside you and give you some encouragement. Or if you realize you've been procrastinating and your desk looks like a mess and you can't get yourself organized, the Psyche Buddy comes along and says, hey, let's work on this together. Mm-hmm. And it is in those fundamentally human connections that we find personal change that can happen. And when we look at peer support, often peer support has those, that sense. It's not only doing the psychologically deep and rich thing, but it's also doing the ordinary things. It's also reminding people that, hey, you know, you've got to eat a little bit more because you're losing strength, or let's go for a walk because it's a beautiful day and we need to get the beauty of nature into your brain for a few minutes.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And an avatar most likely will give the prescription. And then it'll end there. It'll end there.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to wrap up our time without giving any nuggets away. And again, thank you so much for being here, Welton. And then also to the listeners, of course, we're so grateful that you're with us and that you keep this going, you keep the podcast going. And again, as I mentioned earlier, there's a direct hyperlink to Welton's book called "It A Greater Good." And what's a little teaser that you can share with us? I guess is it, and I say that because you know when you're in a movie theater and there's that preview of the next movie, the upcoming movie, and they take these little snippets, right, and then they put it together. It doesn't always make sense how filmmakers do that, but what it does do is it captivates the interest of, you know what? Oh, when's that movie coming out? Oh, it's not coming out till October. It's only April, right? You got to wait. But see, okay, for the listener right now, you're going to get the teaser and you don't have to wait. You can actually go on, click onto that hyperlink and you can download the book or you can purchase it and it'll get shipped directly to you. So you don't have to wait very long. So what's like a teaser?
You know, the one I'm going to pick out. So we talked about this avatar in this virtual reality room. And the young Paraclete or Psyche Buddy, to complete his requirements for independent practice, he has to have some avatar sessions.
Oh, wow.
you know, just as a way. So he understands what it's like for the people that he's going to be assisting.
Okay.
So he goes to this therapy avatar. And the therapy avatar is launching into the protocol of the types of questions that he's supposed to ask and, you know, what therapy is supposed to look like. And one of the questions happens to touch on a trauma that young Paraclete, despite his optimal upbringing, a trauma that had occurred in his life. And it had occurred at a very young age, and he had coped with that trauma by fainting as a child. And whenever there were reminders of that trauma would come along, he would faint and eventually come around. But when the avatar touches on that and creates that, takes the character back into that trauma, the young Paraclete faints in the virtual reality room.
Oh, wow.
But the avatar wasn't given protocol to how do you treat a person that's fainted.
Okay.
You know, the avatar is just, you know, suddenly this person's on the floor. And so the avatar, all the avatar's programming can do is to, well, you go into stasis until the person sits up in their chair and says something.
Wow.
And so eventually Byron, who is the Paraclete that fainted, recovers, and he sits up and he realizes that this avatar had no way of relating to him. And when he had fainted as a child, there was always someone warm there that could come along and, you know, help him get upright and get his wits about him again. And I put that in, it's quite early in the book, as being, no matter how well we define protocols, mm-hmm. we always miss something. There is always some human element that isn't anticipated by the protocol, and that a genuine and complete and a healing relationship requires that sense of spontaneity and freedom to deal with something that we may never have encountered before.
Yep.
But suddenly it is there. And we need to respond. We can't respond just by protocol. We have to respond as a human being to that particular need. So there's the teaser. How does that fit as a teaser?
That's absolutely incredible. And it's early on in the story.
Oh, there's lots of things that you're going to discover about this avatar. It, not everything is what appears on the surface.
Wow. Maybe it'll turn into a movie. So if someone's out there and you're interested in connecting with Wilton about his book, A Greater Good, you know, make sure that you send him a note. And also his website's going to be on the summary bio too. So if everybody's trying to wonder like, okay, how do I buy the book? How do I connect with Wilton? What do I need to do? All of his information's on the summary bio, including hyperlinks to connect with him on social. If you do connect with him, please let him know that you heard him on PTSD and Beyond. It was a great pleasure to have you on. And everyone that's listening too, remember the first episode we shared that Wilton's going to be on in a 3-series segment. So we have one more to share. We've got one more to go. It doesn't end here.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. It was fun today. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. It's been really a great delight to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing the feedback from some listeners on that they got the book. And you never know. I mean, maybe people want to do a book club about the book and even evaluate the practices of psychotherapy and where things might go in the future, as well as the processing that they did for themselves. How do they identify with either, you know, the avatar as well as the buddy?
If people read it as a book club, I would love to zoom in and be part of the conversation.
Okay. Well, if you're out there and you're thinking about, hey, you know what, I got the book and yeah, that sounds like a great idea, drop us a line at hello@PTSDandBeyond and just put in the subject line book club, and someone from our wonderful team, because they are wonderful, we'll get back with you and we'll figure out when we're going to do a Zoom book club kind of thing. Great. Awesome.
Thank you so much, Deb.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Wilton. This is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. And of course, our gracious guest, Wilton. And again, check him out, see that book, and we will see each other again next time. So make it a good one, eh?